House Committee on Health and Human Services Subcommittee on Child Welfare to order this April 28, 2005. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2009, open a public hearing on House Bill 2010, open a public hearing on House Bill 2334, open a public hearing on House Bill 2336, open a public hearing on House Bill 2387. Colleague's agenda, or colleague, I guess, Representative Greenlick, my honorable colleague here with me. We're going to received some testimony from the Department of Human Services regarding some questions that I had sent them. You should have a copy. We probably might make those questions available at some point to the public. So as soon as I get a copy, I will get that to you so you can make a copy. We've opened all those public hearings simultaneously so you can speak to one or all of the bills when you're called up and give us your perspective on these bills. Some of the faces in the back are familiar, so you probably know what we've been doing. It's just collecting information on child welfare issues, and it's the intent of this committee to process all of these wonderful and not-so-wonderful ideas and put them together into something that we will pass out to the full assembly for consideration. So with that, I would like to invite the Department of Human Services forward. Mickey, to answer those questions, whoever is coming. I'm going to pay back Representative Kitts for delaying us 35 minutes. So, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Adalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families.
And for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families.
Great.
And which questions would you like to start with?
Well, I sent you a list of four questions shortly after our last meeting. Some questions came to mind, and what I thought we would do is get a better indication of our system of care for child welfare and how the various oversight boards work together. So I think that you can just start from question one and respond, and then so read question one and respond, and then kind of go up the list.
This being Passover week, several of us are in the habit of doing four questions.
Is it a Passover thing?
Mm-hmm. And these are just other things.
Let me ask four questions on Passover night.
Oh, okay. Okay, go ahead.
Chair Adalto, members of the committee, the handout that you have before you talks about the state fatality review team. In your questions, you asked about the Oregon Citizen Review Board, the Center for Child Death Review, the Child and Family Death Review, and the State Child Fatality Review Team. First of all, I'd like to say that the Oregon Citizen Review Board is the board that reviews the cases of children that are in foster care. Those reviews begin to take place at the 6 months after the child is placed in foster care, and thereafter for 6 months as they move toward permanency. And that is, this is Citizen Review Board is a part of the judicial?
Oregon Judicial.
Oregon Judicial. The State Fatality Review Team is part of the Health Division. These two review boards do not connect. They don't have the same purpose. But the mission is to prevent childhood deaths by reviewing child fatality cases and identifying trends, educating the public on incidents and prevention, and developing recommendations for public policy initiatives. And the role of child welfare in that, we are one of many organizations that are members of the statewide interdisciplinary team, and we present three fatality cases each year with the review, as do others on the committee. Others on the committee are from Health Division, they are from law enforcement, they are from other areas where we identify deaths of youth. And we look at these deaths to determine if there are initiatives or changes in policy or practice. This is one of the places where the concept of children being in safety seats, this is where you might have seen the concept of children wearing bicycle helmets coming from. So we review both accidental deaths and deaths through abuse or neglect.
Okay.
Review every death, every child death.
The state fatality review team reviews. They review child deaths. During the state fatality review team meeting, we review just a small portion of those deaths that we bring forward that may represent trends or practices that we could move forward. I think one of the areas that we were looking at in this last year was the issue of co-sleeping deaths, and we're developing a pamphlet to better inform parents about safe sleeping conditions for their children.
What's a co-sleeping death?
Parents often have a practice of sleeping with their children. In fact, it's a culturally accepted practice, but in circumstances where perhaps the parent's been using drugs or alcohol or prescription medication that makes them sleep soundly, or maybe they're sleeping on a waterbed or sleeping with blankets that are too cumbersome for the child, we do see children die essentially of an overlay or a suffocation death in those circumstances. So the idea of a pamphlet or a news presentation that would assist parents in making good choices around that.
Okay. On the state fatality review team sheet, did you provide these for us?
Yes, I did.
Under the role of the team, it says, finally, the team shall provide recommendations to a local multidisciplinary team in the development of protocols. Are there multidisciplinary teams for all parts of the state?
Every county in the state of Oregon has a multidisciplinary team.
Okay. So what sort of recommendations does this state fatality review team make, or are they just identifying what happened?
Chair Dalto, as I was talking about earlier, there are a number of different recommendations that come out of this state fatality review. One of them was that children wear bicycle helmets when they're riding a bike. There are that children be in seat belts or car seats when they're in cars. We see trends where, like I was talking about, the co-sleeping death, where we look at what is the way that we can get information out to the groups within our state that need that information most. So they can be both about health and safety issues that are of concern, accidental death issues that are of concern. You might have, in a year, you might see a number of children dying in motor vehicle accidents. That I believe there may have been some recommendations that came out of the state fatality review team that had to do with young drivers. It's addressing all aspects. One of the areas that we looked at closely this year was suicides among young people and trying to address what kind of prevention efforts could happen across the state.
Okay. Go ahead. And you don't need to. Just ask whatever you want. Don't say, Mr. Chair, just waste any time. Although I don't want to get you into bad habits for somebody else's committee. I don't care. Let's have a conversation here.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. are you going into other mortality review before we're done? Are we done with mortality review? Because I want to ask a few questions.
I'm done. I was just whatever questions you all had.
Well, there are other review teams that are on that question.
And we did not recognize those.
Okay.
Those teams that are on there.
Yeah, the only other one was the citizen review.
Is every childhood death in the state reviewed by somebody?
I can first describe what we do as a child welfare agency. We have a child fatality review protocol for child welfare.
Is that every child? Any child who dies who's in your custody would be?
And in that, it's any child known to the agency, any child known to the agency within the last year, or a child who is currently an open case with that. And what that means, known to us, means that we had contact. We may have just had an assessment that we closed, but if they've been known to us in the last year, or we have an open case, or that death is through abuse or neglect, we review that death. Then the local multidisciplinary teams also review all fatalities that have occurred in their county, and that would be accidental death, natural death, or death through abuse or neglect.
Every childhood death is on, not just ones that are in your agency, right?
At the child fatality review at the local multidisciplinary team level, and then the state fatality review team reviews a very small percentage to identify trends, to look at areas where there can be some energy toward prevention.
How many deaths did you review in your agency, relative to your agency, in the last couple of years?
In the last, I know that in the last year, I believe we had, in the 2004, I believe that we had 8 deaths through abuse or neglect, but I don't have those numbers.
You said that you review a death of any child who's known to you. So if a child's in an automobile accident who's known to you, do you review that death?
If the child is in our custody, known to us, and in our care, we would review that death. Yes. If you would like to have the number of deaths that we reviewed in the last year, I would certainly be willing to get you that information.
I'd also like to see a record. You can take the names out of it of the results of a death review. I'm not talking about one that's frank child abuse. I'm talking about one that would be a little removed from that, of a child in your custody, mm-hmm. or known to you, as you said. Right. That's a bigger circle, right? There are more right. children known to you than are in your custody. Mm-hmm.
Right. And Representative Greenlook, you're wondering, you'd like to see what that review looks like with the identifying information removed?
Yeah.
Certainly I can provide that information.
Okay. Karina, did you have information about or indication where these other terms came from? The Center for Child Death Review and the Child and Family Death Review?
I saw research saying that Oregon had those review teams, so maybe that's not current. That's what I wanted to find out, specifically what review teams exist.
I don't recognize those.
They're not current.
Okay. All right. Did you have other responses then to these? No? Okay.
No.
All right. Thanks. Okay, Jackie Howard, is Jackie Howard here? I have you signed up, Jackie, for House Bill 2387, which is the adoptions policy bill.
Correct.
Okay. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Howard. I'm legislative assistant for Representative Donna Nelson. She was unable to attend this today. And I've been asked to read the testimony from former State Representative Betsy Close, who was also unable to attend, following us for testimony. Good afternoon, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2387 today, sponsored by Representative Donna Nelson. I am former State Representative Betsy Close, and I am sending my testimony to you. I believe this is a very important bill worthy of passage dealing with the adoption of Oregon children. The topic of safe adoption of children has long been a concern for the Oregon Legislature and for Congress. This concern culminated in the 1997 passage by Congress of the Adoption and Safe Families Act. The act was designed to speed the adoption of children who were seemingly trapped in a hopeless foster care system. These were good intentions, but as often happens, the road to destruction is paved with good intentions. The problem with this act was that it provided a huge incentive to go out and find children for adoption because of the large amount of money and monetary incentives for state agencies to facilitate these adoptions. Soon there were large transfers of children and allegations of mass adoptions and child trafficking began to be heard. Departments of social services were engaging in child seizing beyond what was proper, it was alleged. At the same time, due process for parents were badly lacking. They often had their children seized without the parent being tried for a crime or even charged with one. This is still occurring in Oregon. House Bill 2387 will ensure that Oregon children, when undergoing adoption, will be staying in their own state, close to siblings and other blood relatives who can help to watch out for them. This intent is actually in the administrative rules of the Department of Human Services, but is largely ignored, or at least was ignored in the case of 5-year-old Trenton Awe of Newport, a case I dealt with. Their rules say that a child will be kept close to siblings and that Oregon families will be considered first. You can read Trenton Awe's story in an article by Christopher Stoller, Springfield News, Wednesday, June 2nd, 2004, entitled Left with Many Questions, and that's attached to the written testimony that has been left for you. It tells the story of Corrine and Patrick Gilbert of Springfield, who hoped to adopt Trenton. The couple did everything they could to fulfill the Department of Human Services requirements, but was blocked in their attempt to adopt him. He was adopted by two men in Ohio instead. When questioned about this, Department of Human Services cited a compact with Ohio to conduct adoptions cross-country. Director Gary Weeks was given this article and claimed to have done an investigation, but the agency cites confidentiality as a reason to give no details, even to legislators. Chair Dalto and several members heard this story when a hearing was heard last April 2004 in Senator Fisher's committee. By the way, I am told that Trenton's father's rights were taken away without his signature and without him being tried for a crime. My esteemed colleagues, you have every right to demand to know the details of these cases so that you can do your duty and protect Oregon children in the adoption process. I urge you to pass House Bill 2387 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Please protect Oregon children from possible trafficking to other states under the cloak of confidentiality. Please call me with any questions you may have at 541-974-1263. Thank you for your hard work and your service. Respectfully, Betsy L. Close, former State Representative, House District 15.
Okay, Mitch, any questions? Okay,
thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Karen Webster, this is now on 2009.
Chairman and Board.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Webster. I live in Clackamas County, and I have a granddaughter who's been in foster care for 4.5 years. And we've had her on and off since she was born in her home, and she thinks of our home as her home. And, you know, they say that this is supposed to end in a year, and it hasn't. Sorry. And I'm just here on her behalf because we're the best family for her, her grandparents. And every time she comes to visit us, she goes, Grammy, is this my home? And I go, yes, it is. She has a bedroom there. She comes every month or two. We take her on vacations. We've had her, I've been bringing her home since she was 6 months old, and she's now going to be 8 in May. She's been in this system for 4.5 years, like I said, since September, and in September it will be 5 years. She will be 8 years old in May, and she's been in she's in her 5th foster home right now. And I've lived this from day one. And Children's Services knows my name probably really well because I'm there all the time. I'm always calling to find out, you know, all the things that are going updating. I get no information. It just seems like it goes on and on and on. And I really agree with this bill, this adoption bill, and I think that grandparents, beyond anything else, should be the first line of defense for these children. And if the grandparents have no bad background, you know, if you are a citizen who is has no dad, has no criminal background, whatever, then grandparents should be considered instead of going through all of the stuff that we've had to go through. And she is in the foster care system with a half-brother, and there's some system now that says that they won't separate these children, which I find really hard because I'm not bonded to this little boy. He's not my grandson. He's not our grandchild. And I would always, if they did separate him and we did adopt him, we would always make sure that these two children were kept in contact with each other because I find that very important. But my husband is retired, and we just feel that, you know, we would like to raise our granddaughter, and I think that the state needs to understand this, and the state needs to help us with this situation. So that's kind of my story.
Did the parent of your grandchild suggest or point out to the department when they were deciding what sort of placement they were going to try to create, point out that, let me finish my question.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That maybe they'd like to consider placing a child with you permanently?
I don't know that that's been told to them, but, you know, they're still fighting. The mother is still fighting for these children. Her rights haven't been terminated. They went to court last fall, and her rights were not terminated, as well as the father, who is my son. And they have decided to let her give her another chance, which she has no job. She has no permanent residency. She kind of goes through the system a little just to show she's always at visits. She's always doing the things just enough to get by to make them think that she's, you know, getting it, but she's not. And, you know, it's very hard. It's very hard on the family when we have a home that we could provide for her and a permanent home with stability.
What if the mom doesn't want the child to be placed in your home, for example, or not just your home, but any situation that you might describe, that the mother would prefer a different placement?
Well, I don't think that she would. I think that if she can't have custody of them, I think that she would, you know, prefer that they be in custody of the family. She hasn't done anything to get the custody of them, so it's been very difficult this last 4.5 years.
Okay. Well, maybe then put yourself in a circumstance where there was a mother who didn't want the child to be placed in the home of a grandparent that is a blood relative of the father of the child.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that then the grandparents should be granted the sort of first preference as I take a look at this bill in that situation?
What I think is that each person, each individual case should be looked at it as an individual case. I don't think they need to be all lump summed into one thing, because each case is different. You know, we've been totally involved in her life from day one, and I think that makes a big difference. If you're not involved in their life and all of a sudden you show up in their life and you want to be part of their life, I can see that that would make a difference. But we've been there from day one. I helped give her first bath. I was there 5 minutes after she was born. And her dad, who is my son, it's a drug thing with the parents. And, you know, they have just chosen not to make their life better so that they can raise their children. And it's just gone from bad to worse. And, you know, you look at them and you look that they've been put in 5 different foster homes. They're in their 5th one. My granddaughter's been in 3 different schools. She's been in kindergarten, 1 school, first grade, 1 school, and now she's in a different school. You know, I don't want to see her go to another school. You know, and she's a very brilliant little girl. She's, you know, when she's with us, she seems to be very well adjusted. And, you know, she just needs stability in her life. She needs to be in one spot instead of being taken from here to there to there. And, you know, we provide that for her on a consistent basis. You know, every month I pick her up. She lives in Springfield. I drive down there every month. once or twice a month, depending on if she's got a long day, a long weekend, so that we can have her for a long weekend. We take her on vacation. We have her at Christmas. We have her for her birthdays. We have her, you know, as much as we can. So
have
we make her part
to be
of
her
our
foster
life.
Parent?
Pardon?
Have you applied to be her foster parent?
We have gone through halfway through the system, and, you know, it. They came up with this new bill or amendment that said that they would not separate the two children because, you know, they said they just wouldn't separate them. So we've kind of, you know, we're at a loss right now what to do.
You
but that's why I'm
to
here.
Take both of them.
Yep. The little boy is not our grandson, and we're not bonded to him at all. I mean, it's, you know, my husband is retired, you know, and, you know, we know we can take care of Brittany. We know we can raise her and make sure that she has a good home. And we're not asking for anything from the state. We want no help. We just want to be able to raise our granddaughter.
How old is your granddaughter?
She will be 8 on May 25th.
And how old is your half-brother?
He was 5 in April.
And you've spent time with the half-brother?
No.
Have you ever met him?
Yes, I have met him. But we've never spent time as a family with him. He's, you know, it's just haven't done it.
Did they live together, the two children?
Yes, they've lived together. And she has another brother that never did get into the system. He lives with his father, and they're both separated from him. I don't even think they would know him I think Brittany knows him, but I don't think Dylan does.
And so, in your experience in this case, do you think that the two children, Brittany and the younger boy, should be separated?
I do. I think that they would, you know, I think that they would benefit in the fact that we would always make sure that they were kept together as a family. You know, if they wanted, you know, Brittany wanted to see Dylan, I would call him up, let's get together. I would make sure that happened. You know, and I just think that it's easier to adopt one child than it is two children. In my case, in instances I've seen that there's pictures in the paper all the time with siblings that are split. And I think that, you know, I understand their feeling on keeping siblings together. But in this case, I think it's a different case because of the closeness that she has with her family and her grandparents.
Does she not have the closeness with the younger brother?
Oh, I think she has closeness with him, but, you know, they would never... I mean, he knows that she goes to her grandmother's house. When she comes to our house, he knows that. And it's, you know, it's really hard. I understand that. I really do. But I feel that, you know, she needs to be with her family and not be into stranger adoption. She has another grandmother on the other side that, you know, she would be able to take Dylan if they would, you know, allow that. But for some reason, Children's Services and this lady do not get along, and they've decided that she's not a fit grandmother, although she runs an adult care provider home. So.
Well, I just...
that I don't understand.
Sure. I'm trying to work through what you're suggesting here. You know, on Monday we heard testimony that maybe we should have a policy as a state to try to keep siblings together, which I don't think we have. And in some circumstances, it sounds like we are keeping some kids together and others,
right,
we're not keeping them together.
Right.
So I think we're going to have to do a little bit more work with the department on that issue.
I understand.
And see what the sort of national literature is saying about the best outcomes for the children. But it seems like the situation that you describe is a challenging one, in that one is one of the children is sort of a half sibling. But certainly, I'm sure you have enough room in your heart for that other child, because that child needs some kind of stability too.
I understand that, but you know, you get to a point, you get to an age where, you know, it's hard. I mean, it would be hard enough. We've raised 4 children, and if you were our age, which you're not, I mean, yes. you think about taking 2 children on. One child, you know, you've had, you know how she reacts, you know all the things about her. And to bring another child into that home and be able to, you know, raise it in... give them all the things that they need to have. And, you know, she wants to be a veterinarian. She wants to be a doctor. You know, be able to do those things for her.
Have you consulted an attorney? Have you attempted to go to court to become the legal guardian of your granddaughter?
Done that, yeah.
That's something you would consider doing?
Mm-hmm.
Is that? And have you applied to Children's Services to become the, I mean...
Yes, we.
They need to do something about creating permanency for these kids,
right,
obviously.
That's right. And they, at this point, it could be another 18 months before they're in permanency, because if, you know, the mother doesn't get them, the state is going to appeal, it's going to go back and forth, and I just heard today that it could be another 18 months to 2 years. And, you know, she's 8 years old. You know, she needs to be permanently put in a home. Yes, if it doesn't work out that we can't have them, they need to be permanently placed. They can't be shifted around again. That's, you know, it just seems like it just keeps going on and on and on.
Have you formally applied to them to be
to the state
we went, your granddaughter's legal guardian?
No, we haven't formally applied for that, because we were told that we couldn't because they won't separate them. Right. But anyway.
Sounds like an unhappy situation all around, doesn't it?
It is.
You know, part of the things, as you point out, that these are individual cases, and they have individual case merits. And to what extent we try and give the agency flexibility to deal with individual cases, then we hear that, well, you must keep kids together, or you must try grandparents first. I mean, it really turns into a sort of...
It is. It's
hard to make a clear policy that will meet your case or the next case.
Right.
Your two kids need to be together because they're bonded and everything's
right.
Fine, and they each have a grandparent, and the answer is no, we can't split them. I mean, it really is a...
It is. It is very hard. I mean, he has, you know, a whole other set,
really
whole
other
family.
We really appreciate, Nellie, you coming to tell your story. It's very important for us to hear these stories.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Is Martha Fiala here?
Jesus, it has to be Solomon to...
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. And I forgot how you're supposed to do that. I'm kind of, but you said I didn't have to. So
just identify yourself. And
I'm Martha Fiala, and I own a clinic in Hillsboro called Gentle Steps Children's Therapy Center, and we offer physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech, but we serve a lot of foster kids. And one situation came to mind that is still bothering my heart so badly. One foster mom just very much has had this little girl since practically day one. And so they were so bonded. This little girl's like 3 and a half. This was the only home she's known. So they chose the grandparents that live in Mexico. They put this little girl on an airplane screaming and kicking. She doesn't speak Spanish. She was sent with grandparents in Mexico, and it broke the foster parents' heart. And this little girl is just having a horrible time from what I hear in Mexico. And it just screamed at me, who made that decision to take this beautiful little girl that only knows one thing? And I have personal experience, because when I was working at the med school, I met my daughter that I adopted, and she had been very badly abused a couple of times by her mother, who just was psychotic. And she did live with her grandmother, but, you know, I read at that time, boy, my daughter is 30-some years old, beyond the best interest of the child. And I had my daughter from when she was 15 months, and then we tried to legally adopt her when she was age 4, and then they still wouldn't terminate parental rights until 5, after quite an ordeal. And during that time period, they thought they were going to return it. The mother had just been severely depressed, not psychotic. But my point was, this was the only home my daughter had really known. And so I think it's beautiful that you can hook families up with grandparents or with their family, and I've seen some of that happening. I've seen some of the kids get adopted by one grandmother, and it's so overwhelming for that grandmother, then it moves on to the next relative and that kind of thing. But, you know, my plea is that you just think of each child individually, and whoever would have made a choice to put a little girl on an airplane and send her to Mexico when she didn't speak Spanish and that was the only home. I just want somebody to say, what were you thinking about that little girl? It was her life, you know.
So do you think that in a circumstance like you described, that a foster parent would have a greater right to...
I believe it.
That child?
I believe it. I do believe it. And I think, You know, I work with a lot of foster families now because, you know, we have a tremendous amount of meth babies coming into our clinic. And, you know, I see these poor little disorganized babies and the things that they go to. And I see some very loving foster parents. And I remember at the time, that was 30-some years ago, they promised us, you know, we had to have our daughter as a foster parent first, but they promised us that we would be able to adopt this little girl because the circumstances were horrendous. Her mother tried to put her in an oven and was barely rescued, and my daughter is just incredible today. You wouldn't believe her. But at that time, it was like, and I still think that that's kind of a policy sometimes, that they don't honor a foster parent that has made a good bond. And a child that has made, you got to realize, the ages, when little kids make the bonds is the first 3 years of their life. And some article I read in the paper just discussed how traumatic these kids are. You know, there's a term out for it now. They can't make that bond with anybody as they grow up because they've never been able to establish that. And my plea is just, you know, for heaven's sakes, if the child's in a good home with a foster parent or whoever's established a decent bond, don't disrupt that. And, you know, I don't know how I can impact or change that, but I just think it's a heartache. I just couldn't believe that they would still be doing that after I had to address that with my daughter, she's 35 years old now. So, who would have made that choice? Does anybody know who would have made that choice to send that little girl to Mexico? How could they do that? You know, and the family is still heartbroken. It's a beautiful foster family that, you know, wanted the girl. That's all she knew. I don't know if anybody... That's my only point.
Wow. Sort of not really quite sure what to say. Okay.
More case for not making a fixed policy.
Yeah, right.
One of the questions, how do you provide the guidelines?
Right.
Well, you know, there's the book out, Beyond the Best Interests of the Child. You know, you look at the child's situation, where they are developmentally. Look at the child first, you know, what's going to fit for that kid. And I know that we don't have the money. You know, maybe if we'd had a lot of money, we could have sent the family from Mexico up and they could have started doing whatever. But, you know, evidently we don't have the funds to do that. But that was, you know, I don't know. You know, it's just a child's life, and whoever's making those policies, they've still got to be able to break it down to the individual, you know, what's working, and I don't know who advocates for that. I know that the case managers, you know, I, again, work with a lot of families, and, well, they're, you know, I'm not in there, so I'm sure they are doing the very best they can.
But you're basically saying that if that bond has been created, and it's an important bond, that... That needs to come before the issue of family, and that's a real hard thing to digest, I think.
Well, it is, you know. And I was really, when I took my daughter in, I had this view of the world that I could, if I just was with them and made friends with them, that things would be wonderful. And why couldn't I even work with my daughter's natural mother? And why couldn't we, you know, just have a happiness about us? And then, you know, my naivety with the woman had very, very serious medical issues, and I couldn't take on everything myself. So, you know, I don't know. I think that families, I have several different stories. You know, I worked up at the med school, and as a physical therapist, we're seeing this one little baby and just treating the baby every day, and we were bonded to this little baby. We thought we were doing so good, and we saw this baby for 2 or 3 months. The mother walks in the room. The baby starts smiling immediately, has this most amazing response to this mother that she hadn't even seen. And that's happened before, too, that there's an inherent something in there that they see their parent and there is an instantaneous bond. So you cannot deny that, you know, that's, I don't know what the answers are. But my daughter is forever grateful. I know that she had to go through the rude awakening we never told her what the horrible instances happened because she was happy in high school. Why would you want to have that burden on a child to say, oh, well, you know, she knew she was adopted and her mother had hurt her, but, you know, I don't know. I just want to, just when I saw that you said that for grandparents, and you know, I got to stay today. I was down actually from the Hillsborough Chambers Conference. I have to put my 2 cents worth in just to know, just people to remember to honor the child, you know, honor the child first of all, and it's hard. But just take one extra step to think about what's that life going to be like. And it's not easy. Maybe a mother somehow can be bonded in some way with that child, and maybe that's the most natural too. But give it a safe situation. I've seen them go back. So.
I'd also like to say that we hear about cases. I mean, we do a lot of constituent service, and we hear about cases, and they sound horrific, like the case you just said. And you say, well, they couldn't possibly have made that stupid decision. Then you go check with an agency. I'm not talking about this agency. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about other agencies. You go check with the agency, and sometimes it is your impression, well, that was a stupid decision. That's mostly not the impression. Most of the impression is, oh, that's what was going on.
Uh-huh.
You get, you know, all of a sudden you get the background information, and all of a sudden it makes a little more sense to you.
That
why,
could be true, too.
And that wouldn't surprise me at all in this case, why you put a screaming kid on an airplane and send her to Mexico. It's that there is more to that story, I suspect, than...
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I just heard the one side from the foster mom, and just was really concerned because I happen to know them, and, you know, knew the little girl and that kind of thing, so...
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Can we have somebody from the agency come forward and talk a little bit about the issue of sort of foster care bonding and family, what the policy is? Okay.
I mean, keeping siblings together and grandparents and the whole bit.
And grandparents.
You're the lucky one.
Huh?
You couldn't possibly put a kid on a plane in front of Mexico, right? That's a rhetorical.
Yeah, really.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. I'm Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Adoption Program Manager at DHS. Listening to the three scenarios that were laid out here today really pretty much encapsulates what our job is when it comes to doing permanency planning for children. If we took everybody in this room and said, okay, all those people, if this were all one case put together, the three scenarios that we heard, how many believe the child should go with the grandparent? How many believe the child should stay with the foster parent? How many believe the child should go with the sibling? We'd be split and we'd be all over the place. And for that reason, we have what we call adoption committee. So that what we try to do in adoption committee and throughout the process of adoption planning is to very much take into consideration all of the issues that impact the child's life. What is the child's, where are the child's siblings? What is the relationship with them? Sibling relationships, according to much of the research, is the most important and lifelong relationship that we have. Siblings will outlive parents and grandparents, and that is the lasting relationship. We also have very good literature on attachment and bonding. That's a very important thing that we take into consideration. We also are very interested and concerned about continuity with the child's biological, their family of origin, and want to keep that intact. The best case scenario is that we wouldn't have to be doing any of this planning at all, that children could remain with their biological families. In our planning, we do have a very tight sibling planning policy in place. They are administrative rules. It talks about the preferences to keep siblings together. That is the preference we start out with. Only when we believe that it's not in the best interest of one or more of the children for a safety reason do we end up separating those children if they're already together. Then we go to an adoption committee that's made up of three persons who are not responsible for the direct case planning, the actual case planning for the child. So it's about as objective as you can get in a highly subjective situation. And that committee considers the families that are available for the child and qualified to and interested in adopting the child and weigh the best interests of the child. It always comes back to what is in this particular child's best interest. And there are always people who disagree with the decision that we come down to. A grandparent will disagree that they weren't chosen. A foster parent will disagree that they weren't chosen. A sibling will disagree that they had to be separated in adoption for their child.
Do all three people have to agree on that?
It is two of the three people have to agree. two out of the three, and a backup family is chosen out of that committee. In some instances, we don't choose any family that is originally presented to that committee because none of the families can meet the in the estimation of the committee based on lots and lots and lots of information and lots of testimony, I suppose, presented to that committee on the child's needs and the capacity of the families.
How often does that happen that they're not placed, the child isn't placed with one of the families that's been recommended?
Very, very rarely does that happen, and sometimes what we need is more information about the resources that might be available to a family. For example, if they live in rural Oregon and the child needs a lot of counseling, we may not initially choose the family who otherwise looks good until we can ascertain that those kinds of services can be made available to the child.
The one thing I might add to that is the families that do go before the committee, all of them have met a very high standard. They're quality families. There's nothing to be read into the fact that if one member, one family is chosen over the other two families that might be presented to a committee, the other two families are good, very good to have even been presented to that committee. And sometimes that's a confusing point when a family has their hopes up for adopting a child and they're not selected over another family.
Are they given reasons why they weren't selected? And I don't mean sort of over another family, but some kind of basis of information that can at least give them something to take away from the experience as opposed to just a flat rejection?
Yes.
And is that appropriate to give them some information?
Yes. And we do give that information to them through their adoption worker, through whichever, whatever agency or person presented that family at the committee. And it's always based on the needs of the child. So we may say that this child needed a specific thing that we saw another family as being more appropriate or more able to provide.
Is that a standardized process, or does that vary from region or office to office?
Out of the adoption committee, it varies variants, and sometimes it's verbal and sometimes it's in writing. We don't have that standardized.
For the family?
To the notice back to the family about their non-selection. The reason
why would you do it? Why would you do it verbally? Why wouldn't you also offer a written document?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I think that we do it verbally because of everyone knows when that adoption committee is taking place.
Sure.
Everyone's anxious about the outcome.
Sure.
And then we provide that decision. When it is a...
I guess what I'm saying is if you had some kind of written document in addition to whatever your verbal communication is, it sort of it formalizes or memorializes the discussion so that the interpretation, I don't know about the interpretation, but the reasons that the agency is giving are clear, and somebody may process the information differently in person mm-hmm. because an emotional reaction to whatever the response might be, but the outcome is very clear, and they have that to refer to. That's sort of what I'm thinking. And I think that, you know, one thing that I've been thinking along in the child welfare area is that if we can have more sort of formal, not formal, but some sort of more communication, that structured communication that clearly sets out actions or inactions by the agency, people will at least have something concrete to refer to, especially when these situations are the most sort of emotionally engaged ones. People can think differently at different times depending on how they're feeling at that particular moment. If they have something to refer back to, you know, it's like I get emails all the time, right? And I read them once and then I read them again. I'm like, oh, okay, that's what that says, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe I'm able to understand a little more clearly as the weight of the moment has passed, and then we can sort of think about things in a rational perspective instead of an emotional. Is that...
Yeah. We talk about that when you try and tell somebody what's going on when they've just been told they have cancer. What it showed is they don't hear anything you say in the next half hour. It doesn't matter. This must be the same thing where they just hear they've been rejected. My guess is they don't hear a thing you said to them in that half an hour. How many adoptions a year do you have?
We have between 900 and 1,000 a year.
Have you done an analysis on some of these dimensions we're talking about here? Like how many of them went to grandparents versus not?
We have all those statistics for you.
Can you provide, I mean,
sure, I can give you verbally an idea right
now.
Right. Yeah.
You have to give it verbal, but then written later.
Okay, all right. I get it. Last year, and it was fairly consistent with the previous couple of years, 36% of children were adopted by their relatives. And that was 31% were adopted by relatives who were actually providing the care.
They had been fostering.
Right. They had been fostering the children. And then another 5% were relatives that we went and sought out and had not been providing care. 35% were adopted by non-related foster parents. So kind of equal split there. The rest of the children were adopted by families that we had recruited. Also, a couple of your colleagues have asked us for these numbers a couple of times about siblings, what we do about siblings. And what we found for federal fiscal year 2002 and 2003, and listen, this is a little complicated. 93% of children who had a sibling, one or more siblings, moving toward adoption at the same time were adopted by the same family as one or more siblings. So really what we really do is try to keep those siblings together. And we have families that have adopted as many as 5 or 6 siblings.
Please, it would be very useful if you gave us a little written report on that just for the record. So we have
okay.
And
be glad to do that.
Representative Farr will have it. Well, that's very interesting.
Sure.
So you've got about 35 by relatives, about 35 by the existing foster, non-relative foster. And the other 30% were all new?
Yes.
And how many of those adoptions were in-state versus out-of-state?
Okay. We have these numbers together for Ways and Means. I can't give you an exact number. Most of the children stay in state, right? Most, over half of the children who go out of state to a relative.
Did you make a formal Ways and Means presentation?
We were prepared to make a formal Ways and Means presentation. We didn't get to that part, so you probably won't see that in a transcript.
If you were prepared to make a formal Ways and Means presentation, could you give us those documents?
Oh, certainly. Be glad to do that, yes.
We get all the fun of going over those line-by-line budgets. We really hate to miss that.
Well, I was informed this morning that it's not always that fun. What about one of the comments that we heard earlier in this meeting about the lack of information that individuals are getting from child welfare offices? And let me be, I guess, more specific, but that's sort of a common theme, and I'm trying to separate that from, you know, I'm trying to sort of understand exactly why they're not accessing that information. I mean, whether they're entitled to access information or whether the agency is not communicating very clearly with them in why they can't access information, or whether the agency sort of is very guarded and maybe could rethink the way they present, you know, the, I don't want to say like a rejection, but that, I mean, a grandparent wants information, or a non-custodial parent wants information, and they're not able to access that. Why, and how can we sort of rethink the way we do that, okay, so that people feel better about it?
Well, there are many reasons. I know that there are many reasons, and there are as many reasons, not as many as cases, but a lot. In the case of a grandparent is not a party to the case and therefore does not have a right to that information. We try to include grandparents and other relatives in planning, and therefore we are sharing some information, but it's always we're sharing that at the same time, possibly, that we're sharing that with the parent. But there are certain parts of the case that we just can't talk about with non-parties.
Okay. Can you then at least have some tool in place to let the grandparent or inquiring party know where the child is in the system? So if they're in the process of being considered for adoption or something like that, and I don't mean a stranger off the street, but somebody who has a vested interest in the child's placement, a grandparent, for example, could they at least not get that information that they can't get because it's confidential, but at least to know what the next steps are? Is that possible?
Certainly. That's what's in our Working with Relatives Toward the Placement of Children policy. That's exactly what's in there. And it's those first few days of the case, we identify who the relatives are. We try to get addresses, ways to contact them. We write them letters. We say, your grandchild, Sammy, is in the custody of DHS, and we're interested in talking to you about possibly being a temporary or permanent resource to the child. And then that's really about all that we can say at that point in time. We don't know in the early days of the case where things are going. It's just to inform them that we have custody of a child.
But if you stop and you're stopping at, by the way, we'd like to consider you as a resource, you say, so what we're doing now is we are evaluating all the possible placements, and these are the next steps that are going to occur, and here's where we are right now. Are you also getting that information out?
The letter that goes out to the relative does state some of that, does state some of it. I'm just going to throw the letter in my mind.
Can you come back to us with how that information, what amount of information you're giving out,
sure,
to the grandparents in that circumstance? It seems to me that maybe there's some opportunity to give a little bit more information without going into areas that would be inappropriate to go into. What do you think, Representative?
Yeah, I wouldn't specify that she did, for example, where her grandchild was in the permanency process and knew that there was 18 months to go. It sounded like some information was available, but also some information wasn't. It's very interesting. We hear so much about the confidentiality problem. So we give you confidentiality requirements, and then we hear how those hinder even sometimes your ability to do the job you want. And that is something we need to be talking about. How do we protect confidentiality of people? But how do we make sure you have enough room inside confidentiality to do the things you know you want to do as good social workers or, good agency people? And we hear that banging around, that confidentiality thing banging around. You could give us some guidance on that, on the extent to which the rules might need to be changed to allow you to do your job better.
And Representative Greenlee, that Monday when we were here, I think you asked that question about confidentiality, so I do have some information that I'm prepared to share today. And pass this down.
Yeah, this is one more example. If you're stopped from giving confidential information, but it's information that you would want to give to a grandparent and family. There might be things you might not want to do for important confidentiality reasons, but there might be some cases where we might say if we had these kinds of exemptions so we could be more communicative and do our job better, that's one of the things we can do is figure out how to make that happen, except I guess the federal confidentiality guidelines.
And they are complicated, both state and federal laws. I'll explain the there's three documents that.
Before we get into the documents, can I just ask one more question of Kathy on one of the statements? Did I understand you say that the research says that the most important relationship is between the siblings?
Yes.
To keep the siblings together, even beyond.
It simply is a person's most important lifelong relationship, because a child outlives a parent, and a child's grandparents or other relatives will die, likely ahead of a sibling. That the most important relationship, they are. Full siblings are the most closely biologically related people that there are. The child is more closely related to a sibling than he is to a parent, biologically. We have research. We knew or we thought that there would be a sibling bill up this time, and we did the research ahead of time and have all the literature amassed for you.
Mm. Okay.
All right. I do want to put on the record, as I told Chair Delto, I was ready to vote my kid brother off the island many, many times. I think now I would have regretted doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and Representative Greenlee, earlier you mentioned that we often see a child welfare agency making decisions based on their assessment with different outcomes, and what appears to be on the surface some similar situations. So as soon as Kathy can mention that siblings are important to us and to keep them together, I can guarantee you there will be someone who will say, I know of a situation where they separated siblings. But I can also assure you there was an assessment behind that led to that conclusion as well. The three documents, if I can go over them just very, very briefly, and certainly you can, I won't read from them, but let you have them. I'll talk about the first one that's dated April 28th at the top. This is just a general overview of the questions that you asked, what we could and couldn't share in terms of confidentiality. The second one that starts with federal and state confidentiality statutes. That document identifies the most common records that would appear in the child welfare file, what we call a child welfare file, and each of those have the state and federal laws cited and a brief explanation of those. So when we talk about a DHS child welfare record, I think it's important for us to understand that those are layers of records that actually come from other entities like courts or medical providers or even the identifying part of the reporting party, the person who made the report on a child abuse. Those all fall under different types of statutes. And the third one is the current DHS release of information form. We have used a release of information ever since we've been in existence, but this one we finally have managed to get it down to a single page. It's only taken about 20 years to do that, I think. So what I'll mention about confidentiality, and this is as it relates to child welfare, very often the record that we keep is a family file. And in addition to having these different types of documents in that same file, we will also have different family members in that record. And those family members, depending on their relationship, whether they're together or estranged, custody or not custody, will have a bearing on how we have to interpret requests that would come for certain records. In general, child welfare, I think you can look at them in as having three broad areas: child protective services, foster care, and adoptions. And all three of those areas have specific state laws and federal laws that govern how we can release those parts of those records. When we have a release of information signed by, and I'll speak specifically to a constituent issue, I've worked with several legislators, in fact, probably over the 5 years that I've been in central office, I've literally handled hundreds of calls from legislators who have received a call from a constituent. Almost all of those have been around child welfare, in part because that's solely where I worked the first 3 years when I was with the department. And then as we reorganized, I also handle calls related to self-sufficiency now, the adult welfare system.
One of my colleagues says he calls you for anything, and that's part of it. Well, he really likes you.
Yeah.
So he calls you for anything at all.
We have a single door entry.
Yes.
Yeah. I generally don't know the answer to the questions, but I generally know the people who do, and fortunately they're willing to work with me, so pretty easy to get some information. But if, for the most part, when we get a call or when I get a call from a legislator regarding a constituent issue, I can take some time to do the research at the local level, find out what is going on, get back with the constituent, get back with the legislator about the constituent issue, and very often, just giving them information about practice and policy is enough to answer that question. So we don't need any releases signed to get the information answered. Sometimes it's a question, as you're asking, what about siblings? And we can cite policy, and that's enough to answer a question. There are some legislators who require additional information, more specific, very case-related. Information, and it's helpful then to have this release of information signed. And I've worked with legislative aides. We have this, you'll note at the bottom of the first page of the document with the April 28th date, there's a website, and you can pull up that website and actually print this page for a constituent. I usually suggest that the constituent go into the local office to sign this, and part of the reason is our files are multifaceted, and the constituent calling you may have a very specific concern that they want you to look into. They don't want you necessarily to know all about their record, and this way, if they're talking with someone helping them fill this out, we'll make sure that they have a safeguard of privacy, and they can say, I would like legislator so-and-so to have these records, and then actually identify which records out of that DHS file we can release. And then once we have that information, then we have permission to release the information on that constituent that's in that file. But as I mentioned, we also have, these are family records. So we may have a grandparent, as Kathy mentioned, grandparents aren't often parties to the case. Sometimes they are. There are legal ways that grandparents can become parties to cases. And if a grandparent is calling and saying, I have a concern about my grandchild, and the mother of the child is saying, I don't want to give that information out, we would have our hands tied in that situation. On the second page, there are some things I listed. This is not a comprehensive list, but these are some things that even with a signed release of information, we would not be permitted because of state and federal laws that we could release. The exception would be, of course, if a court were to order us to release this information, that trumps the confidentiality. We can release on court orders. But in general, if a person makes a report of child abuse, that name is redacted from any information that we would send out from that record. That person is that name is confidential. With the new HIPAA laws, there are certain medical records information about someone else other than the person signing the release. There could be some restrictions there.
Mickey, did you have some thoughts about what we talked about on Monday with legislators gaining access or sort of some kind of structured access to these child welfare records that would be an alternative to the House measure that's out there?
Yes. I'll call your attention to about the middle of the second page where it says it starts off in bold under current laws. And this was my attempt to come up with some of these. I did speak with our legal counsel about this and walked away with the advice, it depends. So whenever we want to.
Yeah, I went through the council and got a pretty similar advice.
Well, and actually, over the years, Representative, I really have grown to appreciate that comment. It has saved me a lot of times in the legal arena. The first two are what I've been talking about, which involve getting that signed release of information. That is absolutely the most effective way for us to get details to a legislator. There are probably three or four legislators and their offices that I work that when they call me about a constituent issue, they already have the signed release. They know where I will want to go, and I know where they will want to go, which is to get into the details of the case, so they will already have a signed release of information, and we can start from there. That will work. I just need to have it faxed over, get it to the local office, and then that opens up for some pretty frank communication. Number three is...
About that signed release?
Yes.
I had a case that I mentioned you in this situation. Mm-hmm. Actually, only my second one. Who is a foster parent and is trying to get some permanent arrangements. If he gives me a release, I'm not sure what you can. I'm not sure what you can give me with his release.
Right.
He and his wife's release are the foster parents. I mean, it seems to me. I suppose unless you had some information about them, which isn't the problem here because they've been the foster parent and are trying to make permanent. And you're trying to. I don't know how a release would help you in this one.
Well, and I don't know either. It could be that foster parent has some legal standing that might like intervener status. And I'm guessing if that foster parent did, they're under what's called discovery, which means they're receiving all of the information.
If they're receiving the information and I get a release from them, then you can give me the information mm-hmm. they've received?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is our legal counsel that's coming out. I think I should have said it depends.
Yes, or an absolute maybe.
Good afternoon, Representative Dalto, Representative Greenlick. My name is Linda Gus. I'm a senior assistant attorney general at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm the assistant attorney in charge of the human services section. And my job responsibilities primarily include advising the DHS Child Welfare Central Office folks, Ms. Foley, Mr. Cerise, Ms. Ledesma, those folks regarding legislation, policy, practice, the law, how they can implement their policies consistent with the law. And so I do a lot of work with regard to confidentiality. So Ramona suggested that I come up and maybe answer some questions if that would be helpful.
So I can continue with number three, and then as you have some questions and some of the details, I think Linda may be better.
Well, I don't want to go too much into too many questions, details. Only because we have some other people that are waiting here okay. to testify, so get to the detail, I guess.
Well, and here's my main question that I think you can think of and come back to. She can tell you what you can't do under state law. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to know is, what would you like to do under state law? I mean, what would you like her to be able to say, yeah, you can do that? Mm-hmm. In terms of confidentiality. What our interest is what extent is state law hampering you from doing mm-hmm. things that you think you ought to be able to do in terms of fulfilling your duties?
Well, and I mean,
because you know the political issue. The political issue is they hide behind confidentiality. That's where they're hiding all their mistakes. They don't want to talk to anybody. And they love the shield of confidentiality. Well, I don't necessarily take that interpretation. Mm-hmm.
I think I, from a practice point of view, I think the conversations that we will generally have with Linda and other of our legal counsel staff is we would like to be as open as possible, and then we begin to scale back from that. I think part of the question that has to be asked is what will a person do once they get the information? That certainly is a concern Linda always raises with us, that if the information is, for instance, information that will be given about some private details about a family, and we have a law that says it's okay for us to say that, and that information is going to be printed in a newspaper, what are we doing as a social service agency to that family when that child has to go to school, et cetera? So I think one of the questions we want to consider as we work through this is, what do we want to do with the information on the other end? Now, number three that's listed here is, Linda pointed this statute out to me in this conversation after Monday, that actually talks about its ORS 409.225, and it does talk about the director of DHS having the ability to form a committee that could include legislators to review records. And the way I was reading this, and I'm going to look to Linda to see if I'm accurate on this, that we would be able, with the exception of that list of we cannot share like the reporting party's name, some of those things, we would be able to make that record available to members. That would be like a sensitive issue, or I think the statute calls it a sensitive review committee that's convened by the Department of Human Services.
That's very interesting.
For the legislators, would they get under the bond of confidentiality and be bound by confidentiality relative to their involvement in the process? I think that's the nature of this.
Representative Greenlich, yes, there is a provision within 409.225 that says any information that's disclosed pursuant to that statute, certain circumstances within that statute, including the sensitive review committee, that information remains confidential in the hands of the persons to whom it was disclosed. So there's a redisclosure restriction so that that information is not posted on a website or generally published that could create privacy concerns for families or children.
That looks like a solution there for that other bill. The other bill that sought to gain access to all these records. The solution may be to put
an ad hoc
sensitive review committee. And okay, all right, good. This is very exciting, I understand, because I think we can come to a resolution on that issue. All right, can I ask you a question before you go? And if you can't answer this, I understand. But my question was, on 2010, shifting gears, this is the Inspector General model in the Department of Justice overlooking the Department of Human Services. The conflict of interest argument about whether the Department of Justice could both provide oversight and legal advice to the Child Protective Services.
Representative Dalto, I don't think I can really answer that. I'm sorry. I that's not something that I've been asked to analyze or, frankly, had even thought about. I'm certainly aware of 2010, and I know what the department's position is.
Yeah.
And we do advise, of course, every state agency, and I certainly advise, and we have half a dozen other attorneys or so that work with the Department of Human Services in terms of child welfare, but I certainly haven't considered that and couldn't answer that question.
Could you answer the question then of what the legal definition of a conflict of interest is?
Representative Dalto, are you speaking in terms of, for example, attorney ethics and a conflict where you might represent two current clients that have conflicting interests, and so your representation?
I understand that. I'm trying to sort of answer the question in my mind whether the Department of Justice, the lawyers that provide legal advice, can also sort of ethically provide oversight.
And again, I just don't think I'm really prepared or.
If it was a private practice law firm, I don't think you could serve.
And
both of those functions for the same client.
Certainly, I'd be willing to take that question back and have that reviewed.
I think it was reviewed.
I think Kevin had a position on that. I thought that at least a position of dis-ease.
And I haven't spoken with Mr.
I
haven't spoken with Mr. Neely specifically about that issue.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you.
I mean, that makes us a bit uneasy. I mean, if you give us the assignment, we'll do it. But.
Right. Well, I think we get to explore that question in detail last time. Okay, thanks very much. Nice job.
Cool.
Jessica Stevens, Carla Francis, and Leanne. Is it Deitch? Talk to anybody? We'll see if they're outside. Just a sec. Because we have this panel, and then we have one other person, and then we'll probably just wrap up. So, okay. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks. Chair Adolfo, Representative Greenleaf. Alexander. My name is Jessica Stevens. I'm with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union, and we represent many of the employees in the Children and Families Cluster of DHS. Leanne and Carla are going to speak to the detail of some of the other bills. Just for the record, although we've testified before the committee on 2010 and some other proposals, we still have concerns about the bill as it is drafted, but are interested in working with the committee on some of the bigger picture goals of the bill, and are continuing to work with Sheriff Giusto on the same thing. Just questions of definitions of the various activities of the Oversight Committee, definition of investigations, definition of inspections, and then the powers and responsibilities of the committee at the outset of reporting or recommendations or powers for action.
Jessica, do you have that written?
I can submit that. And then also just a concern about taking into consideration roles of the judicial department and judges who make final decisions about removing children from homes or placing children in other settings. But we did want to emphasize that we feel that that oversight and accountability are very important. However, if the current proposals in the budget go forward, for example, of eliminating 162 frontline positions in the Children and Families Cluster, that any oversight or accountability system is not going to be enough to make sure that we can work as effectively and efficiently as possible to protect children's safety when there's really not enough workers or resources to accomplish that task. So I know Representative Greenleaf spoke clearly that there isn't more money coming CAF's way.
That's true.
But that even just holding on to the current positions that were approved in the last budget would be better than losing all of that frontline staff and resources.
Yeah.
Thank you.
To follow up with what Jessica was saying,
could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm Carla Francis. And I have been working for the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, formerly Children's Services Division, for those who have recall of that division, for over 15 years. In the capacity of my work, I have advocated for appropriate and needed services for my client families. In Child Protective Services, continued adequate funding is important and necessary to enable children to remain either with their current family or to return to their family within a quick and expedient time period. You know, we're all concerned about the services that are available in our communities, including mental health services, medical services, residential treatment for children, drug and alcohol, and more importantly now, more than ever before, is meth. And, you know, what do we do about that problem? Children who are in foster care are needing services as well as their parents in order for them to be returned. Without, and in addition to that, adequate reimbursement funding for foster parents, it's increasingly more difficult for us to be able to recruit and retain foster families to care for the children of our community while their parents are receiving the services that they're so desperately needing in order for their children to be reunited with them. I would advocate for adequate services for children and families so that they can be reunited and to be made whole again. It's important for children to know who their birth families are, to have that sense of heritage, that sense of place, and that sense of belonging. To achieve all of this, we're going to need to continue to provide services to the children of our community and their parents. In addition to what Jessica so eloquently stated, I am too concerned about needing to have oversight. However, too much oversight will grind the process of protecting children to, it will slow it down, if nothing else. However, we want to be open. We want to be able to provide necessary information to the community about what it is that we're doing and the reasons why we're doing it. So we're not objecting to that at all. I guess what we are concerned about is, what type of oversight is needed. If we spend funding for oversight rather than, for instance, legal representation for our caseworkers who are going into court without that, I think that is, it's a travesty that we do have caseworkers who do not have legal expertise to go in there and try to represent themselves in the agency. I think that would be much better spent funds.
That's something that we've been talking about.
Good, because this is something that caseworkers have been wanting for quite a long while. We are not legal attorneys. We are social workers. We would like to be able to spend our time in the field rather than trying to figure out what it is, the direction that we need to go towards, that attorneys could give us that counsel and to be prepared to do that. Additionally, the child welfare program already has oversight by the court system. We have oversight from, as you've already heard, from the Citizens Review Board Committee, from CASAs, the court-appointed special advocates for children. So, we are doing things in an open way already. So, again, I wonder about how it is that the Department of Justice could provide more oversight when we have what we do have in place. So the other thing that I wanted to speak about for just a moment is HB 2009, and I do believe that grandparents do need to be considered when they are available, when they are viable resources, placement resources for children in terms of adoption or even for foster care. Certainly we're working with a lot of kinship parents already. I would, as a foster parent certifier, I probably have two-thirds of the families that I'm working for currently that are kinship parents, grandparents, cousins, aunts, uncles. So these children are being placed with families already. Sometimes these turn out to be temporary placement resources for children. Sometimes they turn out to be permanent resources for children, and this is what we're all wanting for children, for them to have permanency, for them to have consistency, stability in their lives. This is what helps them to grow up and be positive, productive citizens in our community. So with that in mind, I think that there are some things, though, that would keep biological or maternal, paternal grandparents from being able to be viable resources. We do have safety criteria in place that we are able to make those assessments. So there are times that because of systematic reasons, systematic things in families that cause them not to be adequate and appropriate placement resources for safety and protection issues. Some things in their history that would keep them from being able to do that. I do think that it is imperative that we take into consideration kinship parents at all time, grandparents. But again, there are at times things that would keep them from being able to be a viable resource for children. That's all. I made a couple of little notations on what I've already submitted.
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What about this question about oversight? You know, I think one of the things that we see from sort of an outside perspective is that we observe inconsistent application of policy or outcomes, or inconsistent outcomes within the department. And mm-hmm. so, at least on the part of some of my colleagues, given what they perceive as these inconsistent applications, the thought is that they would like to have some kind of independent authority that could ensure that the department is producing consistent outcomes. And don't tell me that it's because we have a need for 200 caseworkers, because we hear that every meeting that we have mm-hmm. on this. So
actually, that wasn't the first thing that popped into my mind.
Okay. We'll stipulate to that. Yes, thank you. So what does pop to your mind?
What pops into my mind is that policy is written in such a way to take into account individual situations. And so what might look like inconsistencies might be very appropriate for individual situations.
Mm-hmm. Well, then why are we having the very public negative outcomes or bad outcomes that we're having?
I could not answer that, Representative Dalton. Mm-hmm.
Well, it would seem then, at least in some circumstances, that those are inconsistencies.
You might very well think so.
Yeah, you know.
Oh, so I'm wrong?
No,
I
wouldn't say that. I was saying that is certainly your opinion.
There's only one human endeavor I know that's really formally tried to get a zero default system, and that's mm-hmm. the space program. As we know from the space program, we had one almost disaster and one total disaster. And that was a system that was clearly pushed to be a zero fault system. Of course, it was, as the astronaut taking off said, his final thought as they took off was that this thing had been built by the lowest bidder. But the point is, that's a very finite system, and an attempt to make it a zero fault mm-hmm. system has never been able to make it happen. So the question isn't why do you have tragedies and human tragedies. The question is there anything we could have done to minimize the probability of that? That probability is never going to get mm-hmm. to zero. You deal with this every day. You know, we have 40,000 calls to the hotline. You're dealing with, 7,000 children, forgetting the number, in foster care. And we're dealing with human systems. What we're searching for is, what are the barriers there, in addition to the barriers of having overworked staff, which is always a true barrier? What other barriers are there to minimizing the probability of having the kind of tragedies we have? And that's what we're asking you to help us with, because you're at the front line. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about total quality management, we always talk about using the stakeholders, mm-hmm. and those, you're the stakeholders. You're an important part of stakeholders, and what we keep hoping for is that you'll say, here are some issues that we're facing in our existence that if you helped us change, we could tell you it would reduce the probability of having bad outcomes. And that's all we're trying to do, is reduce that probability.
Right. I would like to be able to spend more time in the field rather than, at times I feel that I am chained to my keyboard and, barely able to get out of my cubicle. For instance, this week I don't think I've been able to be out in the field at all. I've been in the office. I've been at training. I haven't been able to training foster and adoptive parents. I haven't been able to be at that place where I want to be, visiting with my client families and seeing the children and seeing, how things are going for them, and to be able to provide the services, the adequate services that they're needing. To be able to do more recruitment of families. For instance, I heard about some children just yesterday that were hemophiliacs and needing a medical foster home. I don't have a medical foster home in my area. You know, I always like to help other areas when I can, but I don't have anyone that has those skills that would be able to take care of those children. These are the things that I struggle with. The things that I really struggle with are, you know, what do I do with my adolescent kids, my boys, my girls? It doesn't really matter. You know, those are the really hard children to place. I would like to be able to spend more time recruiting. I would like to be able to spend more time in developing systems that would help these children to grow up and be productive, good citizens of our communities. And those are the things that you know, if I could wave a magic wand, that I would do. I would have the perfect home every time a child came into care. I would have the home in their neighborhood. I would have the home right next to their school so that they wouldn't have to give up their friends, wouldn't have to give up their pet, wouldn't have to give up their school teachers and that sort of thing. Homes that are safe and protective and will help these children to stay as healthy as possible until they can be reunited to their families or to permanency in some other way. So
that was very good.
Thank you.
That's the kind of question we've been asking. That's
yeah,
exactly.
I would like to spend more time away from my community, away from my computer, and in the community. You know, going to schools, going to teachers' association meetings, and saying, "Please help us."
What are you doing at your computer?
Pardon me?
What are you doing at your computer?
I'm writing narratives. I'm writing home studies. I'm, answering emails, you know. I'm working.
I know you are. That's not my question. I mean, I'm trying to understand why. I'm trying to understand how it could be that we could relieve some of the paperwork pressure on you to go out and do what it is that you want to do, and do not respond more caseworkers.
Yeah, well, I mean,
you've already stipulated to that, Representative Belko. I wouldn't venture to suggest that one more time.
Excuse me?
I wouldn't venture to suggest that one more time.
I didn't hear what you said before that, but that's okay. I'm struck by your answer that the inconsistency was my opinion or somebody else's opinion. I'll give you an example. We visited two child welfare offices, one in mm-hmm. Gresham and one in Oregon City. And in the Gresham, where do we go first? Oregon City? So we went to Oregon City, and in Oregon City, Representative Greenlink was sitting with the call intake center, and a report came in, and there was one way of handling that report that crossed over into law enforcement. The fax was sent over to the law enforcement. We weren't sure if the law enforcement got the facts, you know, or when they got it, when it was coming back. Representative Green can explain this better. We go over to Gresham, and mm-hmm. they have a sort of a multidisciplinary deal where everybody's all in one place.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that one system in those two examples mm-hmm. works better than
right.
the other.
Right.
Well, Representative, I'll leave that to Representative Greenland.
Okay.
So if we have a clear opinion of that,
you guys need law enforcement sitting with you. We need to figure out how to make that happen.
Okay, and that's one, you know, that's one recommendation that we'll probably come out with. But the deal is that you have an inconsistent application of your practices, your best practices, from one office to 20 miles away or 15 miles away to another mm-hmm. office. And if we know that one of the systems is going to work better than the other, I mean, I should think that that's a pretty inconsistent practice, you know. And Oregon City, you know, where was the interdisciplinary? Was that in Oregon City?
I think Oregon City had the interdisciplinary.
That was, okay, well, was that originally? It was,
mm-hmm.
right, was that because, you know, we lost two kids in Oregon City 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago, or I don't know. Did Oregon City have that before? Would it have made a difference? No, but, you know, it's a case-by-case deal. But, gosh, if we have something that works real well, you know, we need to make sure that practice is in place statewide. And so mm-hmm. if the department isn't going to do it, if the department can do it, okay,
right.
and that's fine. I'm not saying that they're being obstructive, but but I mean, who's going to? I mean, I don't have the time to go to, you know, 36 counties, every single field office, and say, "Gosh, mm-hmm. you know what? You do it differently here, 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 and here." Mitch and I, Representative Greenlink and I, can show up, and we can see the goods, and we can see how it's done, and we can sit with people,
right.
and they can tell us how they're doing it.
Right.
But I mean,
and everybody was working hard. Everybody was doing
yeah.
great. Right.
Yeah.
Hey, it's really, I mean, it really is issue. And then the problem is, I mean, one of the CERT team recommendations, mm-hmm. I remember in one of those cases, pointed out that things probably happened all right, but they weren't documented correctly.
Exactly.
And then you push more for documentation, and then she's going to be sitting at the desk documenting rather than doing their business.
I would much rather be working with my family. But I understand the necessity for documentation. That was something that was drilled into me 15 years ago, document, document, document. And so I think I've gotten really good at that, probably too good. But I also understand that the need for best practices, an examination of best practices, whether it's here in Oregon or if it's in some other state that is doing something really well. And I think that we do spend time in taking a look at those systems and seeing if there is something that we could implement here. Oregon oftentimes is at the cutting edge of best practices. Believe it or not, we are. There are certainly other states in that are far, far worse than we are, but I'm not going to be pointing those out. The point of the matter is that no matter where the best practice is, we ought to be taking a look at that and seeing if that is something that we could implement across the state. I do know that...
Who's taking a look? I went to Gresham, and in Gresham, the wonderful and talented and thoughtful child welfare worker that I went out with was creating some sort of protocol in the that had to do with when there were drugs in place or something, getting law enforcement with a special team. Mm-hmm. This was really a remarkable thing that worker was coming up with, and she was taking the lead on that. And that's something I think very special, very useful, that could have a positive impact in other offices.
Mm-hmm.
But it's starting at the caseworker level in one office, and they're going to implement it in that office. But who knows, that gets replicated, system-wide. And so, I mean, we're sort of going round and round here. We can think about great ideas here and there, but nobody is and I understand, I'm not sitting here saying that 2010 is a solution to any, to solution exactly crafted for what we're trying to accomplish. But what I am saying is that who is taking a look from the outside in a dispassionate way with some sort of competency that can do this and say, look, you know what? I'm pointing fingers. This is different than here. Okay? And anybody can see that this is different from here. Okay? And so if the department... You're busy. You're writing your reports. You're writing your narratives, documenting everything, and trying to get out to see your families and all that kind of stuff. You're doing your job. Okay. The department is doing their job in their areas.
Mm-hmm.
Who is taking this outside perspective, this outside review? The legislature hasn't engaged this in. I don't know. Maybe you guys can tell me. Not in the last few sessions.
Yeah, but you and I aren't. I mean, we could work all we want between now and the session. We're not going to do that job either.
Well, we're not going to do that job either.
Somebody
needs to do it.
Maybe it's not unique to this agency. The reason we're working on this agency because the sense of the franticness we have to make sure we're protecting our children, which is, I'm sure, the same franticness you have about
exactly
about protecting your children. So, I mean, I worry about it in senior services. I worry about it. I've had legislation on the public health side of it. I worry about it in all these areas. But this seems the one that's really. I mean, I really think you guys are doing a fantastic job. What I think our job here is not to figure out how to make it harder and to screw you up, but to figure out what we can do to help you do the job as well as you want to be able to do it. I think there's some technology issues that we're going to need to talk about before we're done here, too. I mean, there are systems redesign issues that we need to help you with. I mean, if you all had handheld computers so you could be documenting in a much easier and more systematic way rather than typing out longhand cases all the time, you could be a lot better. And there could be a lot of technology ways. States 20 years behind in technology to give you.
Well,
of course, so is the private sector. If you're working in the private sector, you'd be just as screwed up.
Possibly. I would agree that our computer system is needing to be updated, and I've recently heard information that is something that is being worked on, and hopefully before I retire we'll see that. But anyway, those are my thoughts, and I really do appreciate hearing from you that you would like to be able to help us. We do need help, and
thank you.
And we appreciate all of your diligence and your attention to what the need is for the children of our community.
Thank you. Okay. It's Leanne.
Hello. For the record, my name is Leanne Deitch. I'm in, this is regards to HB2334. I'm in my final year of a master's in social work program at PSU. I'm also interning with Service Employees International Union and came across this bill through my work with SEIU. It's clear that the intent of HB 2334 is to protect families' confidentiality and dignity in child protection cases. Our concern with implementation of this bill lies in the ability for social workers in rural communities to provide quality child protective services. Through my schooling and opportunities to hear the stories of rural social workers, I now understand that what we consider to be common sense policy in urban social work settings may not always apply to rural communities. As Oregon consists primarily of rural communities, in these communities, anonymity is difficult to preserve. It's not uncommon for all members of a rural community to be at the very least acquainted with each other, which is the word that this bill uses. If this bill were implemented, how would child protective services be performed in such communities? Would a DHS worker from an agency outside the community need to be called in for every case? What might be the fiscal impact of this strategy? I recently learned from a DHS employee that agency policy reflective of this bill already exists. DHS workers assigned to a case in which they have a relationship with or are related to abuse victims are replaced by a neutral party for investigative purposes. To create a law in which a child welfare worker cannot take action if they are in any way acquainted with the alleged abuse victim would make it difficult to aid at-risk children in rural communities. Most importantly, I think we can all agree that a child's safety comes first always in an abuse investigation. For instance, if there is a need for immediate action regarding a child's safety and the local DHS worker is acquainted with the victim, it could take perhaps 6 hours or a day for another worker to come from another country or another part of the state to take over the case. In this situation, it could create an even more dangerous situation for the child, which seems contradictory to the purpose of this bill. I believe that child welfare workers love children and are likely to be involved in children's activities in the community via themselves or them having children themselves. Things such as PTA or Little League or Cub Scouts or, you know, small community events in which people come together and get to know each other.
So what do you suggest?
Well, my suggestion might be that that the word acquainted with is revisited for the consideration of rural communities. I think, as I mentioned, that the bill is a great bill and it's obvious the purpose in that, but I just fear it might hinder rural social workers and children's safety in smaller communities if it comes down to between an acquaintanceship or and a policy around that versus protecting a child in an immediate situation.
So we get rid of the word acquaintance and put something else in there?
I think the other thing we need to restrict that we may be saying is you're talking about immediate action. We get an immediate call and somebody needs to do something. We want somebody to do something. I don't think there's any question about that. The question is what happens from that point. I mean, if you have a child in imminent danger, you want whoever it is to do whatever they need to do. And I think we need to make that. I mean, we certainly, if we pass that bill, make that clear. The question is, what happens then?
Okay.
And I also worry about the term acquaintance. And of course, the big problem with this is that everybody knows everybody. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't matter. They know who's being abused before the social worker knows who's being abused. It's not going to be a big secret, but yeah. We certainly will take on advisement that a child in imminent danger needs to be served by whoever is the handiest person to serve them.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Last person I have signed up is Karen. Is it Nickler?
Ramona, could I get a table of organization of the agency? I had one somewhere, but I can't find it.
You're saying the cat. You're saying
of your...
Cat.
Yes.
Yes.
Of those who report to you.
I want a big one of those, please.
Big one.
Yes.
You want the one that's us in the central office.
No, no. I want, Mitch is asking.
He wants poster
large
size.
Format.
He wants all the people who report.
Poster
size.
He wants poster
size. Right.
Poster size would be okay.
Exactly.
We can do that.
Okay. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Welcome.
Chair Dalto, I already have submitted this letter to the committee, and I don't know if you've gotten a copy of it yet. It's from the League of Women Voters of Oregon.
I think I made notice of it on Monday, but I believe. Which bill are we on, Karen?
It's 2010. HB 2010, relating to child welfare.
Yeah, I think we have it.
Can I read it to you quickly? And
please do. Go ahead.
Okay. For the record, I'm Karen Nibbler, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As a nonpartisan grassroots political organization, the League of Women Voters encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. The League has studied children at risk and has a national position which states, the League supports policies and programs at all levels of the community and government that promote the well-being, encourage the full development, and ensure the safety of all children. These include child abuse, neglect, prevention, and family support. The League of Women Voters of Oregon does not support HB 2010 as introduced, which proposes to create a child protection unit within the Department of Justice for the purpose of providing oversight to the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division. The Department of Justice currently provides legal services for DHS cases and assists in the review of high-profile cases. The Department of Justice should not be put in the role of supervision of DHS workers. If there are complaints about DHS actions in child abuse cases, this should initiate an internal administrative review of the actions of its workers by DHS administrators or the governor's office. It's not appropriate. It is appropriate for the DHS administrators to invite the Department of Justice staff to provide staff training in legal issues in child abuse and neglect cases. And caseworkers should be instructed in how to work with law enforcement and legal counsel partners in these cases. The League does support House Bill 2221, which establishes a child abuse intervention program in the Department of Justice. The League supports this role of administration of grant funds and coordination of county multidisciplinary teams on the state level. The Department of Justice has submitted a bill which will be an incentive for local agencies to comply with the best intervention and investigation procedures. The Department of Justice has the expertise to educate local multidisciplinary teams and provide a framework for local services. This bill should improve the delivery of local child welfare services. Thank you for the opportunity to express our views.
Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
Should I read into this that if we were to propose this unit in the governor's office that support it?
No, I just meant that complaints about an agency, it seems to me, would go to their administrative staff and to the governor's office rather than to another state agency.
And you understand that this isn't about complaints necessarily. It's about having a sort of management audit function, a function to look about how to create systems that are better and in the agency.
Yeah, well, I thought originally they were talking about these high-profile cases and
no, we've got, there are things in place for that, the CERT and other things in place. So the question is, how do we create an organization that will provide system oversight and look and try and create ways to improve the systems of them?
I think the way to improve the system is to put more resources at the local level rather than putting something at the state Department of Justice level as an oversight there. I would put more resources at the local level.
10 FTE and divide it among the 3,000 workers or something of the agency?
Well, I mean, like provide more attorney help on the local level. And within the MDTs, the district attorneys usually provide the expertise and they help the Department of Human Services caseworkers with court presentations. But maybe they would like to have more legal assistance within their local offices.
I haven't heard that is one of the problems.
Do you think that
I think
more lawyers usually end a solution to any problem.
But they're dealing with legal cases and substantiating the abuse and proving it in court, and, you know, there's a lot of it that's legal.
You think that people on the local level, I don't mean this to be like, feel like an inquisition. It's just an interesting dynamic.
We'll add up. We'll gang up on you. The only two is there's usually seven to pick on you.
Yeah. So do you think that people and more resources on the local level are in a position to look system wide in an audit capacity to ensure that best practices are being implemented system wide? Because I sure don't think so.
If you want improvement, I think you need to do it on the local level.
Think about who's coordinating and who's sort of leading the effort.
I think it should be within the department.
Yeah.
Rather than outside of the department.
I think that you're missing the point of what we're trying to accomplish by this bill. I don't think that you can do it from a grassroots level up. I think that you have to have a central point that's independent of the agency to be able to coordinate and centralize that function. And I just don't see how you get there from a local level.
It seems to me, though, that that's another layer of bureaucracy that you're putting on top of it, and that could be a waste of resources
another
that you could use better.
Another layer of bureaucracy?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Are you throwing that word out there because it's a big, bad, dirty word? I mean, you have 10 people or 5 people or 6 people or however many people that they're going to put together in this unit to do a job, and the job would be to ensure that child welfare best practices are being applied in an even and consistent basis across the state. And without some kind of centralized ability to do that, it doesn't get done.
Well, it's my position, if you want improvement, that you work within the agency and you give them the resources to improve from within rather than imposing it from without, from another agency.
So $100 million to the $50 million, $20 million to find a bunch of more staff?
I mean, you would spend money on the Department of Justice staff.
We would not?
You would have them do it with their current staff, this oversight function?
You know,
I mean, aren't they asking for additional people?
I didn't read 2010 to ask for a new layer. I mean, I think the intention is to do it within the existing resources. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
That's just silly. Yeah. Well, you know, the problem with our little committee here, Mitch, is Representative Greenwich, is that we can't talk, even I, without the microphones being on. You know, you and I can't brainstorm about things without doing so on the public record.
Well, maybe we need to have a work session and just do some brainstorming.
I think we should probably do that. All right. Ramona?
Give us some thoughts, Ramona. Some brief thoughts so we can let you go home.
Some thoughts. Okay. For the record, I'm Ramona Foley, Assistant Director at DHS. Well, I think the afternoon's been very interesting because, for me, it was sort of like a combination plate, a little bit of everything we deal with, the relative issue, the foster parent issue, the sibling issue. I thought the young lady who did the testimony, I actually thought she did her best testimony when she left her script and just talked from her heart about what it's like out there in the field to try to get the kind of work done we're expecting. I think at some point, and I am probably as aware as you all are, that there aren't new resources coming in. There's not going to be additional casework staff and so forth. And yet I think somehow in the long range we have to think about then how do we re-engineer our work? What are we going to do differently? Because we are, I think, to some extent, we're on the Titanic right now. And as you all went out and visited and sat and saw workers trying to man a hotline, where, as you saw, any call that came in could be the next CERT case, it means we have to be brave enough to say, okay, the way we're doing it isn't working, so what are we going to do differently? I thought your point you made this afternoon probably summed up my overall observation in almost the 6 years I've been here. I have never seen a state where everybody takes pride in doing it differently. That is going to be the biggest cultural change we're going to have to take on when Wayne Holder gives his report to your committee in 2 weeks, because it is sacred. It is not okay to say, this young woman has developed a protocol, the lady you were talking about, the caseworker, this works beautifully, she's taking care of drug-impacted babies, because all of a sudden people will turn away from you. Well, we don't care. That's in Multnomah. That's in the metro area. We do it differently in Eastern Oregon. And I have heard that, probably that one thing more since I've been out here than any other phrase, we do it differently here. And you're absolutely right. There are not 36 different ways to do this business. And every time we have a bad outcome, the question the press ask is, well, Ramona, if you knew that there's a better way to do it, why don't you just make all those people do it that way? And I will always say, well, are you from Oregon? I mean, it is something here that's a great deal of pride.
And, her own wings.
And we can laugh about that, and because it is it's a funny phenomena, but I see it, I think it's represented in some of our partner systems around the community. We work with the CASA program carefully. We work with the CRB programs around the state. They each have their own local flavor. The multidisciplinary teams you mentioned earlier, you wouldn't believe all of the feedback we got when we had the Ashley Pond case and we said, wait a minute, we're going to do this one way. We're going to exchange records with law enforcement. We're going to do it one way. And pardon my English, but all hell broke loose. We had people coming up here from law enforcement all over the state, representatives from MDT saying, we don't do it that way in our community. What are you guys in Salem thinking? You can't tell us. You can't prescribe how to do this. So I think in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from today, when we have the Wayne Holder presentation, I think this is going to be our largest
presentation.
I'm sorry. He's the national expert that's been looking at our safety system.
Right.
He's a National Resource Center on Child Safety, and he's going to come and present to all of us. But I think, based just on what I have heard him saying as he prepares to do this, that biggest issue is going to be, you're going to see we are doing everything every different way all over the state. Our court systems, I mean, we have marvelous judges, and Nancy Miller is here. She could speak to that. But even the courts take pride in saying we do it differently in our system. The DA say, we do it differently. Don't try to make us do it all one way. So that is a hurdle for us because, again, I think what we have to have is we've got to have a basic expectation of all staff that are going to do safety. And beyond that expectation, you can afford some creativity. But you cannot afford creativity in place of the basic standards that have to be met in safety. And I'm always telling staff, the last thing I want, if somebody showed up at my house to tell me they're taking my child into care or my grandchild into care, don't tell me you can't give me a brochure or a book that tells me what you're going to do. Don't make this stuff up. What's hanging in the balance is too critical. And I think that's going to be a very hard message for our staff. We've started preparing staff, but they're going to have more direction coming out of central office after we finish this safety review of the whole state. I think we've done a good job of telling them you need to keep kids safe. What we haven't done as good a job is to say, and here's how you're going to do it. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Because everybody goes back to their own community and they say, well, we do it differently here. So that's probably more than you wanted to know. But that's kind of overall what I was hearing today. And I sense your frustration. I told Ways and Means yesterday, I said, if you give us 100 workers tomorrow, what we'll have is just more cases getting open because we haven't changed how we do the business. We got to change the way we do the business or we will never stop this influx. And we've got enough things going against us with the economy anyway. But to just act like we think we know that we're doing it differently and it's okay is foolish.
That's go ahead.
No, well, I mean, what you said, I mean, system redesign is so important in this issue.
It is.
In human services. And it's just absolutely critical. Parts of it's information transfer. I mean, part of it's the ability to bring technology. And part of it, you're just absolutely right. I mean, if I tell you I believe that your child abuse hotline needs to be sitting in a police station everywhere it is,
you're saying to me, yeah, I can see it, and we can pass a law, but we can't get...
You'll have half of Oregon at your door, that's right, saying, no, not in our community, we're not doing it that way.
Well, somebody's got to...
All right, we'll take a bow.
You know, at some point, somebody's got to step up and do that.
Well,
know?
That's. I think, Representative Dalton, that's what we're going to try to do using the expert evaluation. I mean, he comes in here, he doesn't have any bone to pick with anybody in the state. And he's not going to stay. He's going to come, he's going to present these findings, he's going to tell us what he thinks the deal is. And then it's up to the state of Oregon. Is there the public will to make these kinds of changes? I hope there is.
Yeah, I'm fascinated that every time we hear from some of the workers, the solution is we need more workers, we need more workers, we need more workers. And I understand that. And I'd love to give you more workers because I see that, yes, they spend a lot of time in front of their computers.
Can't give you enough
right.
more
but you can't
but
give us
we
enough.
Can't
right.
give enough more workers to fix a
That's
system
right.
that doesn't work because it's
right.
inconsistent and nobody seems to see you know say that. And I wish they didn't leave. I wish they, you know, people come in and say what they want to say and then they leave.
Yeah.
But we're all sort of looking at this as part of a larger... It's in room 50. So looking at this in a larger context, you know, I mean, we're sticking it out, we're working, you guys are, I'm sure it's dinner time and all that kind of stuff, but the bigger picture is we have the systems problems that no amount of throwing resources at are going to fix.
Right.
And so I just don't want to hear that we need more workers because that
right.
doesn't
Absolutely.
Present the complete
no.
picture.
Chair Dalton, the other thing too, and this is going to be, again, one of the things we'll have to take on, is we've allowed a lot of flexibility over the last couple of decades in how the local offices assign the staff that they do have, and they take great pride because they like to be creative. And so there are a lot of staff that are in those local offices that are what we call non-case carrying staff. Well, the only way to lower a caseload, if you don't have more workers to add, is to say more people have to carry cases. So you take your non-case carrying staff, even though they might be doing a function that's pretty important, and say, we got to lower the caseloads. So what we have to do then is take those staff and make those positions case carrying positions, and then that starts dropping the caseload.
Or team the staff with, I mean, have team caseloads with ancillary workers, and I mean, sometimes it's possible that three case workers and two non-case carrying staff can carry five times the caseload because you can organize
right.
your work differently.
If they are assigned especially to that same group of cases, what we have, the configuration we have is more confusing than that, and it came out in the CERT. The CERT said, you know, you've got all these people touching the case. You've got something called an SSA. You've got a child welfare caseworker. You've got a CET. People are touching it, but then it takes more time because then those people have to communicate as to who knows what about the case.
Exactly.
So we're going to take that on, too. I think the field is primed to know that there's going to have to be some significant change, and they have to get past this mantra that we do it differently here, because you cannot do child welfare and keep kids safe 36 different ways. There aren't that many ways to do it.
But the ideal thing would be to find out which is the best one of those 36.
Absolutely.
Everybody else do it that way. Do you have any way to look at, I mean, the fact that you organize staff differently in different offices, do you have any way to get an assessment on which of those are the most efficient and most effective?
You know, we had a conversation about this recently because there's a half a dozen local offices around the state that we have never had a significant bad outcome. They're run in a way, the manager has child welfare expertise. He's known in the community for that. Usually strong connections in that community. Not a lot of chaos in terms of going into an office. It's a fascinating thing because the larger metropolitan areas around this country have much more difficulty with trying to get sort of the culture of what the office is. But we do have some really good examples, and those are not the examples that you're ever hearing from any legislators from those communities, because the legislators know things run pretty well here.
Yeah.
Now they may get an unhappy constituent, because there's always that, as we talked about earlier. So we can make somebody unhappy every day of the week, and in fact make a lot of people unhappy. But even if you get past the case outcome, there are many legislators who say, in my community, they take care of the business. They handle the business. They work closely with law enforcement. And see, those are not the folks that we hear from, and it's not the folks that you all hear from. But I think there's value in that. And one of the things is just getting our folks locally to accept that if somebody else is doing it well, then it's okay to do it that way. And that's real different out here.
the way it's done in the private sector.
In Washington, D.C., they call Oregon the land of 1,000 flowers. Because every time we even get a grant to do something, instead of doing it one way, we have 36 models. And that's a long history. And there are native Oregonians back here laughing about that because they know that that is true. But it is the very thing we pride ourselves on in the state, is the creativity and the flexibility. So anyway, that's probably more than you wanted to hear.
No, it's not exactly what we want to hear.
More. One more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
If we were going to have the kind of organization that's perceived in 2010, and the assumption is it's not going to be in DHS, you ought to think about someday is where you might like to see that organization be.
Yeah,
I'm not convinced the DOJ is the right place for it.
Right, and I have thought about that, and I've thought about models in other states.
You don't have to run the record with this.
Right, but we can certainly share some thoughts with you, because there are things that can be done that sort of take it away from looking like, even if, no matter how objective it is, when something's housed at DHS, people are going to always believe our fingerprints are all over it.
Right.
And so maybe there are some alternatives that we haven't really discussed that might be a place to house something like that.
I just want one more question. That's, I know you got to get out of here. The management, the sort of staffing ratios.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long, involved question. We don't do ways and means, so I don't get to see some of that. But the theory, at least the theory, that some of my colleagues advance is that the agency is top heavy, and that we all can agree that the agency needs more frontline resources. Can you give us, at some point, an idea of what those staffing...
We can.
...staffing situation looks like, whether or not we can reallocate some of those resources to the front level?
We'll give you some more detail when we give you that org chart. We will narrow it down and show you, especially around the child welfare area itself, what that looks like, what the roles are, the people that work in central office versus out in the field. There's a real stress level at that frontline level, because we have our supervisors. Frontline supervisors are trying to supervise, on average, about 10 people. The national standard from Child Welfare League of America is 5 to 7. 5 if it's new staff, 7 if it's, excuse me, yeah, 7 if it's experienced, 5 if it's new. We are way above that national standard. We have something called CETs in our process, and we use those to sort of help supervise. But that's another area we need to look at, because we're not going to get new supervisors either, not enough to fill that void that we have. And that's one of the things that workers tell us. They need to have good supervision. That's like our first line of entry at that local level from a management perspective. And so, yes, we can bring those figures back and give you some idea of what the workload looks like around the state as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That added a lot of value for me.
Thank you.
The engineer of the system will need more top managers, not less.
Okay. We'll just leave it up to you, Mitch.
No, I mean, that's true. If you want to re-engineer the system, then change things like standardizing. Okay. Need more.
Are you ready?
Yeah, we're done.
Yes. Oh, thank you. All right, we got to gavel all these things shut. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2009, House Bill 2010, House Bill 2334, House Bill 2336, House Bill 2387, and this meeting is adjourned. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, we wanted to know if we could...